My name is Jeff Kirsten-Grip. I'm almost a 40-year professor of communication at the University of Portland. I've been there about 25 years. And suddenly find myself teaching communicating science. It used to be an intercultural thing, it is now. And this week we will spend time discovering all the ways that's fascinating and really impactful and changeable. So there are things we can do about the way science interacts with our lives and other people's lives that become visible to us over the course of the week. So I've got four sessions planned for you. You'll see previews of those as we go throughout the day today. Today is mostly focused on just getting oriented to what this even is. I'm really happy to see you. How many people are interested in this, even phrased as dryly as I did on the board? It's like, really, this is what we're up to, is talking about communicating science, and you're here on your vacation. So we'll get to know each other a little bit, and I'd like to start actually with a little bit of that. If you wouldn't mind looking at the person just next to you and saying hello to them. Would you do that, please? All right, time's almost up. Now, whichever person you just chose to talk to, turn to the other person, if you've got another one available. And I'd like one of the two of you, please, to tell the other person the story of one of your names. So one of you tells a story to the other, and it's about one of your names. First name, middle name, last name,
full name.
Just tell that story. I'm hoping the second person you maybe know a little less well.
Hello.
It's your fault.
We had this saying in I teach instruction. I teach teachers sometimes, and we realize there's a certain way of saying something. It almost doesn't matter what you say, but it's a teacher's way of saying shut up.
Yeah.
The teachers, they'll say anything like, you know, hello. It's anything with that kind of intonation. Like you could come in and say, rutabaga. And students would take out pencils and get ready to start writing. Back in the day, now they just like open their phones or something. Can we hear a story or two? If you heard one from somebody about one of their names, could we hear a couple? Could you elbow them with your eyebrows or with your actual elbow and see if they would tell that story? Can we hear a couple? Name stories are fascinating.
Oh, she poked me, so...
Tell your story.
I said, my first name is Carol. My mother liked the name. She also said she had an old boyfriend in high school named Carl, so it reminded her. I don't think my father ever knew that story.
Oh, that's so good. One more? Thank you, Carol.
Yes, I can tell one.
Tell it.
I can tell one.
Do. I can't see where your voice is coming from. There you are. Thank you.
Yes, this is... What's your name again?
Cindy Tuiscu.
She and her husband decided on a common last name. They forfeited their family name and came to a name that was meaningful to them both, which in Finnish means... Carol, what is it?
Windy snowstorm. You don't
want to
get stuck in a tree.
That's great. Ironically, you're reminding me, I went to school with some people who did the same, and that the name they chose for themselves was Holden as their last name. And I don't think they knew about this place. It was interesting to have them choose. So there's method to my madness. You'll be actually talking to each other a lot this week. Today, there'll be three or four opportunities to be talking with somebody near you. You don't have to talk to the person you just talked to. You're welcome to move around the room when that happens. But don't be fooled by the presence of slides and a microphone on me. That I don't intend to lecture. I intend to offer us all stuff to look at, think about, listen to, speculate, and to share stories from experience, to share dilemmas, to speculate about solutions, those kinds of things. We'll do a lot of that together this week. That's really what the week is about. So today, again, I really just want to introduce what's going on, get us used to each other and what this thing is. So let me show you a couple, three slides here, and then I have a question for you to consider with those folks there. Oh, before we start, is there anything you want to know about me? Some people don't want to be taught by just anybody. They need to know some things about the people who are here. Just because I happen to have the laptop and the microphone doesn't necessarily make me worthy of your time and attention.
What's the story of your name?
My middle name is my dad's first name. And when it came time to give our son, to carry on the tradition, we just didn't want to burden him with the middle name of Jeffrey. So we also gave him my dad's middle name. My last name, though, I was born Kirsten. I got Grip from Emily 30 years ago, actually, 2 weeks ago, 30 years ago. So we're both Kirsten Grip. We decided to keep them both and stick them in there. Yeah, that's how I feel. It's like...
We just hit 40, 10 years ahead of
Congratulations,
you.
Congratulations, you two. Hello!
Do you have a science background? You said communicating science is a new thing for you. How did you get into that?
Well, I am a social scientist. If you look up, if you want to see what I do, you could just open Google Scholar and enter Kirsten Grip. I think I'm the only one. And you can see the kinds of work I've done and who's using that work. You can see who cites the work. So yeah, I am a scientist. I study people rather than studying the natural world. I guess we're part of the natural world, though, aren't we? Other things? Does it help if I do that? Not usually. Well, let's start. If you think of other things you want to know, please do ask me. If you ask me something I don't want to answer, I'll just say I want to answer that. So when we're thinking about science and its role in how we interact with each other, there are a few things to notice about this particular slide, just to start with here. Politicians told us repeatedly lockdowns were causing increased number of death by suicide. We kept asking to see the data, now we have it, and apparently this was not true. In 2020, deaths by suicide were lower than in the previous 3 years, and here's the data. So this is from the Journal of the American Medical Association, right? The journal's here. So one of the things to notice about this is we have in our culture, we rely on science and scientific thought, scientifically produced conclusions as sort of the final word about things, for better and for worse, as you'll see, as we talk about. So, you know, she's using the word true, right? It was not true. Second thing to notice is that because it's known that we rely on science. Lots of people want to use the word science and use scientific-sounding things to achieve whatever aims they want to achieve. It was in somebody's interest to have us believing that suicide is up during the pandemic. So that becomes spoken until we can counter it with data. The third thing I'd love you to see is just look at her handle.
That's what I saw right away.
Yeah, the angry EPI, the angry epidemiologist. So, you know, we feel strongly about this stuff, and especially the folks who do science are really wedded to what is science, what we're actually doing, and how we ought to be thinking about that stuff. So we'll be unpacking today, we'll look at science communication ultimately, and I'll get your opinions about some things that we can talk about and think about relative to that, and relative to Jubilee, actually, the theme this year. But first, let's just unpack some more about what we see as the consequences of this kind of stuff happening in the world. I don't know if you had any folks in your life who were concerned enough about the science that you ran into folks like this. This is a sign on somebody's front door, right? This was an early piece of mis and disinformation saying if you've been vaccinated, what's actually then happening is you're starting to off-gas some dangerous stuff, so we can't be around you anymore. So that, you know, that led to things that are pretty consequential for folks that have to do with sometimes our ability to live. Folks in healthcare talking about people on their deathbeds denying that they had COVID and being really, you know, more than cross with healthcare providers. And a lot of that was happening on the political right, and yet the political left is no less susceptible to the stuff that we're going to talk about this week. What do you think the next slide is going to show as the thing that we on the political left are more are inclined to sort of mistrust the science about? What do you think it's going to be?
GMOs.
Go, Steve. We're really wary of what we put in our bodies, so we're really about purity when it comes to food, and we don't trust genetically modified foods. And yet, the American Medical Association, World Health Organization, the European Union, the Royal Society of Medicine, National Academy of Sciences, all conclude nothing to worry about. It's safe. And yet, there's still that just feeling. Right? Like, no, really? Maybe I'll choose the non-modified stuff. So just want to show you that it's something that's out there that is prone to, we're all prone to. It's been weaponized more in one slice of society than in other slices of society. We'll talk about that this week too. But our relationship with science is complicated, to borrow Facebook's term, you know. How you get along with science? Well, it's complicated. Because on the one hand, we created science, right? We created science to try and distinguish alchemy from other things that were more supportable in the world. We had to come up with this method to sort of vet things. And yet we're also the ones who are consuming science in ways that do and don't make sense to us and that do and don't honor the science that's there. So our relationship with science is complicated. It's also interesting. I'm so pleased to see you here again for the first day where I didn't make it sound very interesting and you're still interested. It'll just get more interesting. And as we move through the week, you'll start to recognize ways that the current status quo around communicating science, the places where it's kind of slippery, where we're not doing it really well, those things actually are changeable, certainly at an individual level, at an organizational level, even at a cultural level. So there are things about it that are not immutable. We can actually do something about it. So here I'd like you to turn to one of the two people that you just said hello to so vociferously. And I'd like you just to think with each other. This is going to be just a formative task. You don't get to think a lot about this. But why do you think the COVID-19 coronavirus pandemic, our experience of it, why was that so puzzling? See how many reasons you can come up with. Why do you think that puzzled, whether or not you were puzzled, why do you think it was puzzling for people? By the way, I'm speaking on Mass today because I don't enunciate very well. We have air moving in the room, and we'll try to remember not to be near you. But if I do, like, come around and you'd rather not have me there, just go like this. It will remind me that I'm around other people and it's a pandemic time, and I will be careful. I'm about as boosted as you can be, so we're good. So 4 minutes start now. Why do you think the COVID-19 coronavirus pandemic was so puzzling? See what you can come up with. 4 minutes. You're on your own. Rutabaga! I want to let you know, too, that this session today and all week actually are going to raise more questions than they're going to answer to your satisfaction, probably. So know that these people that you're talking to now exist outside this room, so do I. And I hope that you are able to keep those conversations going. Lots of opportunities here to chat. So I intend to raise a lot of questions. We'll address some of them pretty thoroughly. But the idea isn't to give the answers. The idea is to say, well, what do we know? And what don't we know? And what should we do about that? There's speculation about all those things. I want to introduce you to one of my favorite science communicators, Ed Yong. It's a real thing. Ed Yong writes for The Atlantic often. And so I also want to introduce you to a practice. So rather than hearing what you came up with here, I'm going to invite you to do this. Go, mmm. Mm. And you can add this if you want. So, mmm. So I want to show you some of the reasons that this science communicator thought the coronavirus was so confusing. And after each one, I want to just create a little space for you to be able to say, yeah, that was one of ours. So for example, one of the things Yong points out is that the virus itself was confusing. There isn't just one coronavirus, right? There's six others known to infect humans. They're hard to work with. They don't grow well in cell cultures. It's been hard to get funding. Okay, that came up for a lot of you. Or are you just like making that noise?
I like the noise.
I like the noise. Or the disease, SARS is the virus, COVID-19 is the disease it causes. They're different. Did we know that? Yeah. The virus might vary a little around the world, but the disease varies a lot. Some of the most important stats about coronavirus have been tough to pin down as a result because it manifests in different ways. So the disease and the virus were different. We love to see patterns, right? As humans, we really, if you study communication, one of the things you really discover is we are story beings, and we're driven by narrative more than we're driven by empirical truth. Yes. Somebody presents me a good story, I find that really compelling, and it's really hard to set aside in favor of things that maybe are counterintuitive, but even better supported. So especially when you ramp up fear, uncertainty, hype, it's not surprising a lot of sort of folk medicine or other kinds of things that fit the story come up. There was a documentary pretty early in the pandemic called Plandemic that was it was a hoax, basically, but it was really popular. It got a lot of traction. So the disease itself? Not as much as the virus. How about the research? Ed says, this is how science actually works, right? A lot of people don't understand what science is and how it works. It's less a parade of decisive blockbuster discoveries that the press often portrays, right? Especially when they contradict each other within a year. And more a slow, skeptical, erratic stumble toward ever less uncertainty. Isn't that nice to think about scientists going, oh, hey, we're closer. Yeah?
Well, it's true, yes.
It is true. How about this one? Here's another. the experts. So expertise comes in a lot of forms, and we got to see a lot of it and a lot of non-expertise also during the pandemic. So it's not only about what you know, but also about the capacity to spot errors and why experts need other experts, right, to vet our work. That's why we do peer review for the work that we do with each other. A lack of expertise becomes problematic when it's combined with extreme overconfidence, right? So we tended to, the former president during, I know the press briefings that were happening for a while there during the pandemic were all about portraying confidence and all about just being absolutely certain about how things were going, speaking like a salesperson about the pandemic. And we tend to go with that. That fits the story of what we think science is for. We reward projected confidence over humility. When scientists offer caveats instead of absolutes, that uncertainty we're trained to acknowledge in our own work makes it sound like no one knows what's going on and creates opportunities for people who present as skeptics. So my own students have a real hard time with when they're writing their own first kind of studies. They want to say, you know, my study proves this. And we just have to have them lose the word proves to say, well, your study adds support to the hypothesis that you proposed. But you haven't really proved anything, especially in social science. Steve?
Well, that's, psychologists have observed that, I think the saying is something like, ignorance more often begets confidence than knowledge.
There's a really good TED Talk out there called Why Are So Many Incompetent Men Leaders? And it's a psychologist who studies in South and Central America. The which?
The Dunning-Kruger effect.
Yeah. So, and it talks about we tend to prioritize confidence over other kinds of markers of really good leadership. Go ahead.
I think the fact that Trump is tall and really brash, mm-hmm. and Dr. Fauci is small and very humble, I think that led to a lot of people, mm-hmm. do we really trust this little
right.
man?
Yeah. You'll like this one when we get there, too.
Okay.
So pandemics demand both depth and breadth, and the strongest attractor of our trust in a really fraught time shouldn't be confidence, but the recognition of one's limits, tendency to point at expertise beyond oneself and the willingness to work as part of a whole. So there's a humility built into doing science right. There's a famous debate between Bill Nye, the science guy, and Ken Ham, who built the Noah's Ark exhibit down in somewhere down south, where they're debating, you know, creationism or whatever. And one of the questions they got asked was, you know, what would change your mind? And Ken Ham said, nothing. And Bill Nye said, any piece of conflicting evidence, you know, would change my mind. And that's really the scientific. Scientists are out there. We're putting our stuff out there kind of saying, prove me wrong, please. You know, yeah. I'm ready. I'm happy. Let's get it better. You know, let's refine what we're up to. So we're also confused by the messaging itself. There's something about the sorts of messaging we're used to hearing. So during the pandemic, we heard a lot of stuff that was kind of alarmist, like, hey, close your business. Wear masks, stay in, you know, especially in countries that really just absolutely shut down. And we respond to that kind of alarmism as like a danger sign, like, oh, wait, no, you know, you're too alarmist here. I shouldn't trust that. There's something just about the alarmism in the messaging that also puzzled us about the pandemic in here. This one isn't alarmism, right? There's a cultural script that we play, and when the script changes, it's time to shift to a new one. I hope the lesson people take from this isn't that the experts were wrong. If you followed the right people, they were overwhelmingly right. We just didn't put them in the right place so we could hear them. So messaging isn't just about what's being said, it's also about what's being amplified and made available to us. We have a lot more available to us now than we used to. Please.
I agree with you that scientists seem very open to contradictory evidence, mm-hmm. except when you're messing with the paradigm that their science is based on.
Right.
They're much more resistant to any challenges mm-hmm. to the paradigm.
You know why that is?
No.
Because we're human. Right? It's like, wait a minute, my whole reputation is tied up in this. I've been working on this for 40 years and you're going to set it all aside? I don't think I can abide that, so I won't pretend to make a scientific argument. Yeah, I'm with you. So fuller statements take longer to explain to message, right? There's a lot of uncertainty in science, and we shouldn't try to tidy it up. One of the things we'll talk about later in the week is when you're reporting about science, should you report the caveats, the uncertainties, all the reservations? What do you think?
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah, you should. And how do people respond to it when they see like lots of reservations in a scientific report, right?
It must not be true.
And scientific journalists tend to this kind of want to excise that stuff because it makes a better story, right? We think we've developed a new thing. So if we were clear about uncertainties from the start, we can better hang on to new information. We can put it in frameworks we understand. and understand when shifting evidence can lead to new policy. And then the information itself, right? Oh, I've been letting you make noises. Anybody thinking about the information itself? To clarify our future, we try to gather as much information as possible, and we can't stop. Historically, we'd have struggled to find enough. Now we find too much. Yeah? That's how I felt. I just felt overwhelmed. I was treated for anxiety for the first time in my life. I'm just trying to deal with all the information that was out there and how to think about it, how to feel about it, how to move through it. It doesn't help that our online information channels are heavily personalized and politicized. There are a couple of really good documentaries out there showing kind of the machinery behind our social media, for example, how we keep getting presented more and more tailored versions of ourselves rather than other things, rewarding what sorts of extreme claims we like, yeah. And that, right, that puts us into non-nuanced spaces. This is a piece that's really going to be vital for us this week, is thinking about the difference between misinformation and disinformation. So as time passes, misinformation, which refers to misleading stories that are circulated in good faith, will give way to disinformation, falsehoods deliberately seeded to leverage the disaster for political power. So, yeah, you know.
You said we're going to talk more about that?
Indeed, Carol.
Okay,
yeah.
Good.
So, and it's a tough problem, the information. We think that if journalists just did a better job, if they were more determined and asked harder questions and kept putting this stuff out there, that would fix the problem. This is not a problem fixable by journalists. It can be, you know, chipped away at by how we do the science journalism, but that's not the only thing that's going on out there. Then the numbers themselves. One of my colleagues is really big on innumeracy, that we really don't understand how to interpret numbers often. And often, scientists' means of gathering data is the most complicated part of the science, right? The numbers I see say as much about the tools researchers are using as the quantities they're measuring. Yeah, mathematical models that have guided our responses have been portrayed as crystal balls, but that's not their purpose. They're describing a range of possibilities in ways that are ever more understandable by us. That's the hope, anyway. And then finally, the narrative. This is really interesting to me as a communication scholar, is that we construct stories to wrangle meaning from uncertainty and purpose from chaos. Isn't that fantastic? We crave simple narratives, and the pandemic, this pandemic in particular, didn't offer one. It still doesn't. You know, lots of different experiences of the condition from people, short haul, really low symptoms to long haul, severe symptoms, deaths, all kinds of things happening. And the desire to name an antagonist, that's something we love in our stories, right? We need a villain, disregards the many aspects of our current life that make this pandemic possible and ongoing. Anybody? Yeah, love it. All right, let me hop back into the flow here. So why is this so confusing? So Ed Yong, if you want to look him up, he writes a lot for The Atlantic, but he's a name I would recommend if you value how science gets reported. Ed's good. I don't know him. I don't know why I just called him Ed. So the space we're in this week is about science communication. I just like this capture of what that means. Effectively relating science to the public, including one at a time, is a science in itself. Right? What does it mean to actually get your expertise from where you have it to where other people inhabit? And expertise on a topic doesn't guarantee expertise in explaining it. How many of you have had teachers who clearly knew their stuff and really shouldn't be in a classroom? Yeah, right? You can go with both those things. It's like, wow, you're really smart. I am never taking another one of your classes. So it's, you know, you can see those kinds of things. It's like when, you know, all these people, here, let's do another experiment. How many of you believe flossing your teeth is important? Raise your hands. How many of you do it every day? Right? Different sets of arguments, right? We all are convinced, but it's a whole second set of things that have to happen to make it come true. So we're thinking about communicating science. This is the realm we're living in this week. So let me show you today's only video. It's about 3 minutes long, but it does a nice job. It's from the University of Oregon's Science Communication Research Center that tells you a little more about what this is so you can see where we're headed. This is Dr. Ellen Peters' center down at UOL. Science music.
Scientific innovations across many fields have ended up making such a difference to the quality of people's lives. But just because you build something doesn't mean that people end up accepting it, and it doesn't mean that people end up using it. In the end, human beings are the ultimate actors when it comes to science. They're the ones who understand science, pay attention to it, or don't. They're the ones who perceive the risks and benefits of new technologies, act on climate, maintain their health, support different policies that have to do with science, or they don't. Many of these decisions relate to how well people understand, engage with, and ultimately use science. Key to all of this is evidence-based research and science communication. Ideally, science and science communication would be easy, but they're simply not. What ends up happening is that people often don't know the facts, they don't use the facts, they even sometimes just simply reject the facts. Our vision at the Center for Science Communication Research, and we call it SCR, is to lead cutting-edge science communication research that addresses some of the really complex problems that are faced by Oregonians and are faced by other people in our nation. And particularly, we're interested in issues around health and the environment. We are conducting research in science communication itself. We're looking at how people process numeric information because numbers are important to science. But we're also doing things like understanding how people respond to some of the risks in the Pacific Northwest, like earthquakes or wildfires. Our first priority is to conduct groundbreaking research in science communication. We also want that research to make a difference. We want this research to be interdisciplinary and collaborative and connect us with other U of O scholars that end up seeing us as important and even critical partners in research. We also want to highlight the importance and, in fact, the usefulness of University of Oregon research as well as research in science around the nation. The University of Oregon is really important in terms of being able to build up a center for science communication research that's going to be impactful and that's going to make a difference in the world. And the reason is that the University of Oregon is inherently interdisciplinary. We have scientists and other kinds of faculty who work across the University of Oregon collaborating together on projects that make a difference to Oregonians and the nation. We want to teach students at all levels about effective communication research when it comes to science, because we want both students as well as other scientists to go out and tell better stories of science. We'll prioritize events that help to build our skills in science communication and help to build collaborations with other scientists around the University of Oregon. We're planning on offering an undergraduate minor as well as a graduate specialization, and we hope that you come and take classes with us. Evidence-based science communication is needed now more than ever to communicate effectively about health and environmental kinds of issues. It's needed to overcome politically biased knowledge resistance, and ultimately it's needed to encourage more evidence-based decision-making among the public and also among policymakers.
So there are several of these around the country. Would you raise your hand if you have ever had a course in science communication? What sort of course was it?
For statisticians mm-hmm. working on collaborating with others.
So really a kind of a niche, here's how you then get this across to people?
Yeah, the intent really was for working with other scientists, but there were elements of it that were applicable to communicating with the general public as well.
Okay. Anyone else? Is this a common subject?
No.
That we're taught, right. So let's unpack the two terms before I ask you another question here. One is, what is science when we're thinking about science? One definition I like is that science is systematic, right? It's not random. When you're learning science, you're learning a method. You're learning a way of doing something. You're learning a way of knowing. It's skeptical. I love this word. It's built in. The premise is that I'm probably going to do this wrong. My methods are not going to adequately capture what's happening in the world, so I have to have that in mind both as I'm designing, as I'm doing, and as I'm writing up what I think I've found, that that's all part of science. It's an enterprise that builds, organizes, and communicates knowledge. Builds, organizes, and communicates knowledge. So we don't just have knowledge handed to us, right? We've developed this system as a way of actually creating knowledge, shaping knowledge for ourselves. And then put it in a form that we recognize, the organizing, and then communicates. That's probably the least well thought out thing. It's become much more a thing in the last few years. In the form of testable explanations and predictions about the universe. So it involves careful skeptical observations in the world. I formulate conjectures, best guesses, hypotheses, we call them, from what's already been discovered. Like I read all the good stuff and I say, from this, what do I think I'm going to find in my own study? I make a prediction that ends with a period. If I'm not sure, I pose a research question that ends with a question mark. But either way, I'm focusing what I'm doing around something that's out there. And then I use experimental or measures-based testing of deductions that are drawn from those hypotheses, leading to refinement or elimination of the hypotheses. There's that skepticism. I'm proposing these hypotheses, but you know what? I'm first going to try and say that they were wrong. Oh, they're not wrong. Oh, there's a greater than chance likelihood that the thing we're predicting actually happens. So let me make that argument for you. So this looks kind of dry, but science is actually really fascinating. And it's counterintuitive in terms of how we do it.
Can you back up on that last?
Yeah, I can. The thing that just went by is something we'll talk about later in the week, just to show that it's not as uncomplicated as we think it is. A scientific hypothesis has to be falsifiable to be credible, right? That's the whole ballgame. So scientific consensus has less to do with scientists agreeing and more to do with their studies agreeing. Right, so when you hear the word scientific consensus, our temptation is to think of it as people all getting along, almost never the case, right? Yeah. So, and there are some characteristics. If you like this, I just encourage you to Google the words characteristics of pseudoscience and look for a chart that looks like this. It's nice. Mostly it encodes things that betray overconfidence or grandiose claims or kind of anecdotal work, or that somebody's out to get us and we're doing this work anyway. There's a lot of sort of signs you can find that are ways of seeming. Remember Steve Colbert, he had truthiness as opposed to truth? So this is like science-iness, things that are like trying to co-opt all the things we love about science without actually doing the work. So one of the words associated with science is theory, as in you're in an argument with somebody and they say, oh, that's just a theory. And they mean that as a diss, right? And you could say, well, yeah, that's a theory. It's really a good one. It fits the available evidence, right? So it's not dreamy. It's an explanation that we embrace usually confidently but provisionally, right? As long as it's supported by the data that are out there, I like it. And I will tout it. And you can talk me out of it. You know, as soon as you show me some data that needs a different theory, some other way to explain things. What's going on in the classroom. For example, in my own research, I study the saving of face. You know what face work is? We do it all the time. Like, why are you looking at me now? Why aren't you looking out the window? Why not?
Because you're talking.
Because I'm talking. So what? Yeah.
We right. respect you.
So we do these things to each other all the time as a way of sort of reminding each other that we belong doing this work, doing this play together, and we want it to keep going. We want to make sense. Somebody trips and falls. You do things to help them, you know, not only feel better, but kind of get through the moment together. We do a lot of that work in our daily life all the time. You're nodding, for example, sir. I don't know why you're nodding. You just did it again. But that we do those kinds of things really automatically, right? You're nodding again. That are meant to be affirming and saying, okay, you know, I don't hate this. You aren't doing this, right? You're nodding. So we have all these things that we just do automatically with each other. My research is focused on understanding how that works in classrooms. So when teachers do and don't have that awareness and ability to actually think about that stuff in the midst of teaching, when you're thinking about saving face or preserving face for yourself and your students and the whole relationship, what changes about what's possible in the classroom? So when we're thinking about theory, I'm using a theory about, this is a theory of identity, actually, identity negotiation, and it fits really well the data that we've come up with, all the things that happen as a result of teachers who can do that sort of thing. So the rest of us generally agree with theories. We plug our TVs into sockets, we measure a year by the length of Earth's orbit, and many other ways we live our lives based on the trusted reality of theory. So just a theory is really a misnomer when we're thinking about science itself. I love this. Right. So when we're thinking about science, you know, the same folks who will say that's just a theory, it's like, you don't ask them if they believe in it, ask them if they understand it. Because there really are empirical truths that we have agreed on about the world, and we try and move through the world as if those operate that way. So then here's the part that's maybe newer, is to think about, well, what do we then mean by communication? That's science. So what's communication without the science attached to it? I want this definition for us today. It's the process of understanding and sharing meaning. When you major in communication at a university, you aren't learning to be an excellent public speaker, although that often happens, or a great interpersonal communicator, or a really good worker in a team. You just understand more about how it is that we shape meaning with each other. That's really what communication majors are good at, is they recognize that's what's actually happening in the world. They see the machinery of what's happening here. So it's the universe of interactive forms, interactive processes, interactive structures that govern how we relate to the world. That sounds pretty highfalutin, but it includes a lot of stuff, and in particular, these two things. So that means that things that we do with each other, if you're really studying it from a communication perspective, you aren't studying it in isolation. You are always interpreting things that happen. May I touch your toe?
Sure.
Thank you. You're always interpreting things that happen in the context of histories, right? Contexts, situations, relationships, and identities, right? So if I did that to somebody on the sidewalk or walked up to a public speaker in the middle of a speech and just, you know, grabbed her toe and did that sort of thing, it would have a different sort of meaning. Did anybody of you feel awful about me grabbing this toe? Do you feel awful?
A little odd.
He
said yes.
Thank you. So when you're studying communication, it's much bigger and deeper than we think we're studying, I think, when we study communication. And we aren't just studying about, you know, the presence or absence of talking. We're looking at how all these things happen. How do we create meanings with each other in the midst of all these things here? How do we understand those pieces here? And the other piece that really kind of broadens what we study in communication is that communication embraces two things. When you're studying communication, you're studying both message making. So we're studying communicating science. We're interested in how do scientists and other people create messaging about science with each other. But we're also interested in then how do people then make meaning from that messaging? What can we predict about that? What sort of patterns are available? And how can you sort of get in there and maybe make for better meaning making here? So we're interested in people's exhaling and inhaling of each other's messaging. If I were to ask you to stop communicating, could you do it? Frank, stop communicating.
Can't do it, sir.
Thank you. So there are things, when you're looking at communication, silence is also really communicative. You know, you ever been in an argument with somebody who then just stops arguing? Meaningful, yeah. So we're interested in all those pieces. Plus, the stuff that we prioritize in communication is we tend to focus more on the meanings than on the messages, more on the outcomes than on the intentions. So would you do something with me? Are you willing? I want you to flip me off in a minute, if you're okay with that.
In a minute.
Okay, well, really soon. So I'm going to compliment your shirt, and I'd like you to flip me off. Nice shirt. So, audience, compliment or insult?
Insult. It depends on the interpretation.
Right, so I'm asking you to make an interpretation. In this case, go ahead.
I was driving a school bus in the early days, and I had some young kids, and one of the kids said, "You know, that driver just flipped you off." And I said, "Well, he was just trying to wish me to have a nice day." Guess what? I was trying to say, well, you could interpret it the way you wanted. The kids took that and took it to the bank. Every day they said, "Have a nice day, driver."
Did they do it that way?
They didn't even have to flip me off. I knew what they meant.
They were just saying, "Have a nice day." That's fantastic. That also points out how early in life we get clever at this. Right? We figure out the game. We figured out when we were raising our kids that how much of your raising of kids is telling them not to trust you. So like Tori would come in and she'd say, "Where's mom?" And I'd say, "She's in Argentina." And she'd look around and she'd say, "No, she's in the kitchen." It's like, yeah, very good. So it's like from a really early age, you sort of figure out, oh, there's kind of a game going on here, you know, that we're all supposed to be part of this thing. But smart communicators would look at that interaction and would probably judge from the response, not from the apparent intention. Let's do it again, but this time let's both laugh, okay? Nice shirt. Now what is it?
A joke.
More puzzling, right? It may be a joke. Who knows? Maybe we're seeing each other together after a long time. But the point is, when you're studying communication, it's not as simple as just looking at what is one person exhaling at somebody else, the end. You're really looking at least a double interact. You know, what happened there? What was the response? And what seemed to be the meaning that was made in that kind of circumstance? So we apply that same thinking to science communication. It's a thick subject matter here. So three things here, and then I've got a question for you. One is, when we think about communication in science, then, in scientific context, first of all, communication aids in even the scientific knowledge we can create, right? Because we're kind of limited to the codes that we know and the things we have words for and the norms that we have for actually communicating with each other. So there's something about the system that puts us in that space. Second, communication doesn't only express things that are out there in the world, but it's also actively kind of shaping that knowledge. We'll talk about some of that later this week, too. Communication isn't a neutral channel. It's not a neutral mechanism. It encodes what counts as an important question. It tells us, we think we know what a meaningful answer is. When you ask somebody a question and they respond in a flip way, you know it's a flip way. by how they communicated it, right? There's something in just the communication itself. There's something in that code that you recognize and go, that wasn't a serious answer. I think I need to press some more. So that's there. Steve?
So why are there so many Johnsons in the Minneapolis phone book?
Why is that?
They all have phones. That's an example.
I love it. We accumulated a Johnson in our family. We had a great-great-grandfather who got to Ellis Island with the name Kujakuchuri from Finland and left with the name Johnson. So I had uncles, great-uncles named Toivo, Eno, Eno, and George Johnson. Central Minnesota.
We're Johnsons.
What were you before?
Well, Stutz. Staabaas.
And that was just too much for somebody?
Yeah, they just said Johnson.
So communication also encodes what we honor as a sensible explanation, an acceptable account, a superior argument, that I think we don't recognize that all these things are just encoded in our communication. The stuff we're doing with each other every day over meals in the dining hall, we're reminding each other what these rules and standards are just by saying hello. It's built in. It's not neutral. So we're trying to study communication as though it has all these pieces going on in it. Finally, Thomas Kuhn suggested that our language systems then also affect scientific practice by reminding us what sort of ideological assumptions and commitments that we have that are in our communication. For example, American English has a big emphasis on individuality. You're supposed to be your own person and think of yourself pretty much in isolation. I always ask my students, especially the seniors, how many of you intend to move back home happily after graduation? And there are always two or three students in every class like, you know, they're kind of wary to put their hand up. And that then leads to a discussion of, well, then, you know, why is that? And, you know, how do you talk about that? How do you think about that in your world? That filial piety is a big deal in a lot of the world where I'm at college to become a better human so I can go back and serve my family even better for the rest of my life. Yeah. You know, that's really what I want to do.
Yeah.
So that's what science is about here. We've got disagreement about core issues and even core facts. When we're thinking about science communication, it's essential to in a free society. But if we can't be unanimous on core propositions, what is necessary to have a functional social reality? We needn't and can't all agree that the same things are true, but a critical mass needs to agree on what it is we do that distinguishes truth from falsehood, and more importantly, who does it. This comes from the conservative writer Jonathan Rauch, who says, we let alt truth talk in our society, right? We let folks communicate. But we don't let it write textbooks, receive tenure, bypass peer review, set the research agenda, dominate the front pages, give expert testimony, or dictate the flow of public dollars. That is why we don't mail Elvis a Social Security check, no matter how many people think he is alive. So, you know, the things we believe versus the things we know, that's still part of what we're up to here. And then we really do have to deal with at some level, we have to have some agreement about which things we'll say are true in the
That's
world.
That's not true anymore.
What is it?
Because the alt-right is writing textbooks. They're rewriting history and not talking about slavery and not talking about evolution.
I think the claim he's making is that we shouldn't be, right? And this is a conservative writer saying he doesn't like that. There's something about this when we're stepping away from the things we know are empirically true about our experience and crafting different sorts of things, that's a real challenge. And it shouldn't be happening. You prompted another thought, and I just lost it.
Oh, I do that to people.
Alternative facts, you mean?
I hate that term. That's why I put all truth in little quotation marks.
Is
there.
Is it part of, you know, we talk being social media, doesn't have to go through peer review and all that?
That was it. We used to be able to tell the really crappy stuff, the stuff we could ignore because it looked like it had been photocopied 6 or 7 times. But there were signs that this is not reputable things. But now, two things are available to everybody. Great graphics and availability on search engines. So you're as likely to get a hit from something like Stormfront. You know, when you're searching for something, you might wind up on a neo-Nazi site presenting something as news as likely as the New York Times. You wouldn't necessarily be able to tell because everybody's got great graphics now. The other thing everybody has now is the ability to broadcast. Social media has made us all not media consumers, but also media producers. And so it's a lot harder we have much less control over what sorts of things are pushed out there and embraced by lots of people as sort of a ground from which we can build, that those things really have shifted over time. Yeah, the textbook thing has really been troubling, reading about school boards and things, what sorts of truths they're more and less comfortable with. One little note about that, I've learned in Germany, for example, there's real embracing of their history, that you don't graduate from German primary and high school without a real understanding of what we did during World War II. Mm-hmm. There are no monuments up to World War II in Germany, unlike our own country, where lots of Confederate monuments, which often went up much later, are still exist.
And
so
really
there are a couple different approaches.
And really good museums that show mm-hmm. what happened.
Oh, yeah.
And they leave the burned out churches and the bombed churches and things
yep.
up.
Yep.
So that's the monument.
That's right. And in this country, folks have been arguing that that damages learners, that damages people. To know those truths is somehow harmful. It makes you ashamed to be the person you are. It's like, that's interesting.
Shame is good.
So, last little bit here is to think about when we devalue expertise, science, and facts, the whole concept of truth loses meaning, right? It starts to get eroded. It doesn't go away, but we really start to question which things are true. Can we use phrases like alternative facts, you know, or alternative truths? It becomes really difficult to have reasoned debate. Authoritarianism wasn't the only cause of the January 6th attack on the Capitol, for example. Confusion played a key role, what might be called a failure of knowledge. We don't understand, you know, which things are true in the world. So too few of us have been able to differentiate between fact and fiction, especially about politicized topics. So as you know, we've got a misinformed movement that endangers everybody, mistaking authoritarianism for democracy, refusing to participate in basic public health, ignoring the very real threat of climate change. So I'd like to think that what we're studying this week has some real consequences. It's important to understand, how does this machinery work? How are we participating in it? And how could we participate differently? I'd like you to look at this list of questions. This is something from folks who study science communication, who say these are questions that scientists really are interested in. And I'd like you to turn to that partner again, if you would. You've been listening to me for much longer than you will in any other session this week. And just, I'm wondering which of these questions feels most important to you, either of you, which of these eight? So just have, I won't read them to you, but do have a look and spend another 4 minutes or so thinking, which of the questions would you sort of settle on as, yeah, these are questions we really think that should be asked by people who want to study science communication. What should we know? Does anybody want me to read them out loud? I apologize, too. I forgot to put the captioning on that video. I'll do that the rest of the week. Anything to clarify?
Can you explain what God terms
right.
means?
A political God term right now is the word tough. It's just unquestioned that people are always better when they're tough versus when they're not tough. It's an unquestioned kind of thing that's out there. So there are some ways that we think about science as well, and my brain is blanking right now on some. But things that have reached the level, we don't question them anymore, we just hold them up as, well, of course, this is always, you know, in play and should be.
Gravity.
Gravity? Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's an alternative theory of gravity out there now, too. The Earth sucks. No. No, I really did read. There's another alternative explanation out there for gravity. All right, chat with each other. You still have a few minutes. Any of these strike you as, like, these are really key things that communication scholars really should pay attention to in science?
I am. I teach adults. It's crazy.
This is preschool.
Yeah. It's funny how much that stuff works. All right, folks. Can we hear from some of your favorites? If you came out of this discussion with kind of a strong feeling about one of these, could you talk about that? Which of these feel like, yeah, that one really merits some study?
Seven.
How come?
Uh-huh. How come?
Yeah.
Because it, when you encounter one of those, it shuts down discussion. It's very hard to mm-hmm. poke into that area because mm-hmm. it's sort of like, it's the paradigm thing in a sense, right?
Right, the phrase that scientists use for it is called epistemic closure. Is that when somebody offers that thing, it sounds like they're continuing the conversation, but it's really a way of opting out. When somebody says something, this isn't a God term, but when somebody, the equivalent is somebody saying, we should just agree to disagree. You know, that's not an invitation to keep talking.
Worldviews seem to be important. Many scientists, if you ask them what they believe in, they'll say, I'm a materialist. If you're a theist, you're easy to conclude, well, what you're coming up with can't be true. But right. In fact, it can be true, even though the worldview contradicts what you believe in.
Yeah. Others, what do you think we ought to be studying? What should we be looking at? Which of these issues? Go ahead.
Therefore, how are standards established? Like, how do we agree on standards?
Here?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. How do you know when you're basing your work on good work? What counts as good work? There was the famous study, since debunked, about the vaccines that were causing some kind of, were causing autism. That's what it was. That was the argument that was since debunked. Go ahead, Mr. Busdriver.
Added to that, once you have that new standard, mm-hmm. what mechanism gives you the courage to keep questioning?
Mm-hmm. Right. Should we settle into those standards and just say, oh, we're done with that now?
Aaron just persuaded me that two is important.
How come, Aaron?
I'm a professional statistician. We use that word all the time. Right. We're trying to get away from it because the way we use it technically is not a good fit with how it's understood mm-hmm. in everyday language.
So what are the alternatives? Which ones
that's
are you?
That's a bigger thing than I can answer right now.
But are there any other terms y'all have been talking about as, that would be good, or are you just trying to reclaim significance as its statistical term?
No, we're trying to. I think a lot of statisticians are trying to give up on using significance in a statistical sense, and even giving up on the idea of that, and trying to focus more on what claims we make that about the meaningfulness of a claim mm-hmm. rather than what we have thought of as the statistical significance.
Very interesting. Any others that strike you as, yeah, these are things? Go ahead.
So, prefacing the idea here that we need to agree on what facts are, so
yeah.
some of them that have been talked about with significance mm-hmm. and standards, right, two mm-hmm. and four. What follows that, my nephew has convinced me that maybe what we need to talk about next is what is rational? How do we talk mm-hmm. about rationality of arguments? Mm-hmm. Because even if we can agree on facts, right, mm-hmm. we need to have common set of standards of how we
yep.
discuss.
In my own field, communication, people do communication work both scientifically and in a humanistic lens. There are rhetoricians in my field too, and people who do critical research. So there's also kind of a broadening beyond only rational, thinking about emotionality or emotional facts in people's lives, right? What are some predictable truths? And is, if something is emotional, is it automatically irrational and thus can't be seen scientifically, can't be understood that way? So those conversations are ongoing too. That rationality thing, Jim, is a big deal. So this is part of what we can look at. There's more, of course, here when you're thinking about doing science communication. I'm going to skip a couple of these here. I want you to see this, though. When people think about science communication, we're going to narrow it down now to something really specific, and then I've got two more questions for you as we finish. One is this here. This is when we oversimplify science communication, there's a deficit model that's widely held by people. It's really simple. It basically says if you're not a scientist, you don't really yet know what science has to say on a topic, and that scientists do. Right? In this model, the science of some important question is settled, it's immutable, it's clear to the experts. The task of communication is simply to explain those facts to the public. So we're kind of back to that opening cartoon where the climate scientists were laughing at the COVID-19 scientists for saying, well, all we got to do is just tell people the facts, that'll work. Right? But that it's not that simple, right? It rarely, if ever, operates that way for several reasons. Here's one little thing we'll look at in either tomorrow or the next day. Union of Concerned Scientists has put out a disinformation playbook, for example. What's happening out there in the land of pseudoscience? For what reasons and what things have we seen? What sort of patterns are available? Not explainable by a model like this of science communication. So science communication has lots of challenges, some of which has to do with just all the moving parts. Any bit of science has the people involved, messaging that needs to happen, audiences that are there, and channels that connect all of those people, all of it happening in context. And then underneath that all the things about science that are counterintuitive for a lot of people. It's unlike the ways we typically think on a day-to-day basis unless you live your life in a scientific frame of mind. So we lack a familiarity with science and with scientific findings and issues. the findings can seem insufficient or uncertain. We can use mental shortcuts because we just kind of give up on trying to understand the complexity. So we think, well, Dad, do you like this idea? Okay, good. That's enough for me. You know, I just kind of do that instead of thinking through the science. And in many, many cases, we are really invested in our own personal, relational, economic interests, beliefs, and values, and we protect them from information that would call them into question. So all these things really get in the way and complicate what we're up to.
And have people define research. I love it when somebody says, well, I've done my own research on the vaccines. It's like, what lab did you use?
Yeah.
How many people were in your study?
Yeah, that's another word we've been over-abusing. Maybe that's one of the God terms, is research.
Oh, yeah.
Have you done your research? It's like, yes, I did. I talked to my buddy.
Yeah. I looked at the internet.
I talked to my dog.
So let's talk really specifically, just these three slides will just show you three ways that we currently study communicating science, and I wonder which of these three overlaps with your understanding of it. Okay, I teach this, by the way, every summer at the University of Portland with a chemistry colleague, and the first time we taught it together, Steve was very much of this tradition of communicating science. So he said one major approach is we study the rhetorical tactics scientists use to try and get their stuff out there. I do complicated work, I want you to understand it. Here are all the things I do with my poster presentations, with my talks, all those kinds of things to make sure that I'm doing the best job I can, that the message I offer produces the meanings that I want it to in that kind of situation. So we look at kind of the classic canons of rhetoric. You know, how do they invent what to say? How do they tailor to their audience? What purposes do they bring? How do they arrange? How do they deliver? Those kinds of things. So it's really focused on the science is kind of standing there. My job is to sort of look at what I've created and think about then how to put that out for people. That was very much my colleague, Steve. I've since brought him around to these other two views also of science, communication. Here's the second one. Going beyond thinking of the science as sort of a standalone objective thing that needs portraying to people is also science communicators study science as a means of argument. So we see science less as sort of a process of discovery and more as a process of arguing in the culture. That opens another door. It's not contradictory with the other one. It's just like, oh, I didn't think of that. That science is itself a kind of argument that we're there. Scientific truths, the data don't speak for themselves. They're not self-evident. I have to argue and I have to link my arguments right through discussion and debate in ways that embody and interact with the values and agreements of a community. Right? So knowledge is human and fallible, arising out of change and controversy, pursued by invested communities of knowledge. These folks, I love this, say if science communication really was just a matter of demonstrating truths to audiences, why is the history of science mainly discarded theories and changes, right, that we've made over time? So they point to that as evidence for we're right about how to study science communication. Think of it as an argument. Then there's a third one, finally. And this one is the richest that looks kind of at communication in its most constitutive form, saying that, you know, Carol, you and I don't have a relationship except that we shape it all the time with our communication. I haven't seen you for a year.
Yeah.
How you been? We'll catch up later.
Okay.
When we do that sort of stuff with each other, I mean, where this approach would say we are actually creating the relationship. It exists as long as we're doing that kind of stuff. So communication isn't a sign of things. Communication is the cause of things. This approach to studying science communication says scientific communication is the thing that is creating and constituting the very object about which it's supposedly only reporting. Yeah. That there's so much power in the medium itself that it is actively shaping what the science is. So it's not an objective medium. This scholar says scientific discovery can be more productively thought of as a process of the creation of facts and objects, in which rhetoric and communication play a central role. So it's really important to study communication because you're seeing how we're actually creating that knowledge with each other. This one blows your mind a little bit, right? This is where you kind of go, wow, we've been here for an hour. You know, you dropping this on me? This is a hard one to think about. So when you're thinking about those three, I mean, those are sort of the three options. You can think of it as science communication is just what are the tactics people use? How about science as an argument? How about communication as constituting the science? All three can be true. They're all just different doorways into the same kind of realm. It's super interesting to get there. One more task for you, and then I want to see where you would go with some issues here. Oops. I want to see where you would go with some issues here. Would you please These are ranked, they're numbered 1 through 5, but I'd like you to actually, with the same partner, or if you're sick of your partner, you could say, I am sick of you, and you could turn to somebody else and do this task with them. It's entirely up to you. You can even do it really ostentatiously, like just leave that part of the room. What I'd like you to do is to re-rank these in the order that you see them as most important. You'll notice the early ones here, simply to share the findings and excitement of scientific discovery, increase the appreciation for science, right, as a useful way to understand and navigate the world, increase knowledge and understanding of science related to a specific issue that requires a decision, to influence people's opinions, behavior, policy preferences when the weight of evidence clearly shows that some choices have consequences, and to engage all of society's diverse groups so their perspectives about the science, particularly on consequential or contentious issues to them, matter and have weight in seeking understanding and solutions to problems. So I'm only going to give you, again, 4 minutes to do this, but I would very much like you to think about how would you rank these? And I'd suggest you start with what you think is the most important and the least important, just as a starting point. The middles can be a little fuzzier, but where do your thoughts go? Two without a microphone. All right, folks, let's hear your opinions before we run out of time. I have one more question for you that's going to be pretty impactful, so I want to be sure we have time for you to think about that. Those of you with strong feelings about which of these you would prioritize, which goals would you really hold up and say, if I had to choose just one, I think science communication really ought to go here. Balcony people, can we hear from you? Go ahead.
Number 3.
Why?
Would be 1. Because I know so many cases where there's been a really important science thing where mm-hmm. it's just misinformation. 4 or 5 sound good, but I know people that have turned them to bad because of their own, what they think is important, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I just know that 3, if mm-hmm. we're able to have and understand, mm-hmm. You know, all the different parts, mm-hmm. like, I mean, there's just so many cases where people have talked to me mm-hmm. and they're clearly missing key parts mm-hmm. of, you know, what the issue is. So,
Are you in the medical field? Hmm? Are you in the medical field?
No.
But it sounds like you're thinking, like, this is the purest expression of what science ought to be about. It's like, get clear about this stuff.
This is right about science communication.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead, Steve.
I look at that and I think that each one is a prerequisite for what comes next.
Interesting.
And so can you really, I mean, I want to say 5 is the most important, but you can't get there without the others.
Exactly. Interesting. So some kind of bring others along with them by implication. Go ahead, Jim.
I'm actually kind of thinking that the prerequisite order is exactly the opposite. Mm-hmm. If people are, and this comes from my conversation, right? If people feel that they have a stake in science, mm-hmm. that it has consequence to them, mm-hmm. and then maybe they will seek out the understanding which is so readily available, mm-hmm. and then eventually maybe they will just simply be excited by the fundamental science.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Very cool. A couple more thoughts.
I really like 2 because it's so general. Mm-hmm. It doesn't pick on anything. It sets mm-hmm. whoever you're communicating with up mm-hmm. to... use that in every one of these other things.
So this would be a priority for you in all your science communication. Is somebody, by the time they're done dealing with me, they should have an even greater appreciation for the act of doing science and what it's about.
Yes.
Great.
He's a retired physics teacher, though, so you got to take that into account.
I heard the word piggyback, so let's hear from you, and then we'll come here.
The communication part of it, I think 4 is the most important, because right now ignorance is killing people and is likely to kill more. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And if you have all the others, but you can't persuade them to respond mm-hmm. to the information, mm-hmm. there's really no point in having mm-hmm. it. You have to be able to persuade them and yeah. influence them, or it's all for naught.
Okay, so you do see science as more about, mm-hmm. it's got this persuasion beat in.
I think the general public doesn't understand that science is going to change. Mm-hmm. And so 2 is, you know, that needs to be mm-hmm. part of the basis of understanding science.
I agree.
Because yeah. once it changes, then it gives the other side or whatever it is, mm-hmm. that's not valid.
It welcomes demagoguery and skepticism and sure. kind of throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Go ahead.
I really appreciate that 5 includes engaging society's diverse groups, because there are more ways to view science than just mm-hmm. the Western model.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I think that's important.
Yep. The thing I love about this list is you don't actually have to choose,
right?
Right? So whatever makes sense to you, these are just kind of five reminders that when you're doing science communication, can you do all of these? Can you keep them in mind? Can you kind of hold each other to account and say, are we doing enough of number five in how we're doing this? How about number two? You know, have we done that part of in our messaging at least? You know, hopefully people don't flip us off in return. They actually get the message that we wanted them to get here.
I think we underestimate the power of one, because I think when somebody has joy in what they're doing, that really communicates to people.
Doesn't it?
Yeah.
Students call it passion when they see it. Yeah. But they and when they see it from a scientist, it's like it makes them really love the science and love doing the process.
Is that true? I feel like in our society, though, things get sensationalized so much as well, you know, that it also questions.
My last task for you today, I'm going to show you this slide and one other, because I'd like you to answer both questions at once just to see what we can come up with. And I'll be your stenographer. I'm going to fill them in on the screen so we can save them. But I'd like us to come up with some key dilemmas, social dilemmas, societal dilemmas, relational dilemmas even. Which things do you think are tied to communicating science? Which things are impacted by participants' ability to understand and engage in science communication with each other? Where does it feel like it has a stake? And then here's a more specific version of the question. Or do you see any of those issues? In fact, can you create any that feel like they impact Jubilee's call to practice, release, renew, and return? So in particular, Holden's commitment to justice talks about these things. So does communicating science play any role in being able to foster diversity through deliberate invitation and welcome? Does it play any role in an ethic of equity to confront and dismantle systemic oppression? Does it play any role in practicing inclusion by listening to, learning from, and being transformed by marginalized voices? So I invite you all back up. Well, you probably want this one on screen so you can see this reference, but I'd like you one last time to consult this partner or some other one that you like better and see if you can come up with just some dilemmas that feel like, you know, these are legitimate things that we really should examine as related to science communication that actually has something to do with our ability to accomplish Jubilee if we were going to try and do this. Okay, so this is the hardest question I've asked you today. It comes appropriately at the end, and this is a question I hope you'll keep asking yourself over the next couple days. But take 5 minutes for this one. And again, I'll be your stenographer when the time comes, and we'll just add them to the PowerPoints. We've got them. What are some issues? Hey folks, can I tell you what a pleasure it is to do this? To have a room full of people who are totally into these ideas when you're on vacation? I'm on sabbatical since May until January and I haven't been teaching at all. And it's
awesome.
Like, oh, that's right, this is what it's like. So thanks very much for doing what you're doing. It's fantastic. We're going to have a really good week. So your hand is up. Would you start us off? I will be a stenographer and try and capture some issues that we feel are relevant. Yeah, it is. Yeah, I'm trying.
Oh, I don't know if that's what I was thinking of. There was a guy here last time I was here who had a chart of scientists, what they thought things were really important and crucial, and what the food was.
Yeah.
They mostly aligned, but there were like three or four key things.
Yeah.
Including one being the one that you mentioned already. What one was nuclear power and GMOs.
Mm-hmm.
Where the public was like, oh, this is terrible. And the scientists were almost unanimously, it's actually okay. Mm-hmm. And you know, okay. I didn't know if that, I mean, that's what I was thinking of in terms of, you know, key dilemmas. Like, those are key dilemmas in our world right now.
Yep.
Right? It sounds like you were looking for something.
Well, do you like this one? Safe energy generation is a way to capture at least one of those.
There we go.
So does that have any relationship to our ability to do the work of Jubilee?
Yep.
Why?
Yeah.
I heard a yep.
We don't have an energy means that we can apply to the whole world soon enough to save a lot of lives. Mm-hmm. We don't have it right now.
Right. Lots of folks are being threatened by climate change at the moment, and safe energy generation might have something to do with that. So how do we actually reduce that gap between what scientists know to be true about certain methods of, you know, energy generation and what the public believes to be true about that stuff? Continue, please. I will be your stenographer.
Vaccine uptake.
How do you see that related to Jubilee?
Well, that was the harder part.
So you don't see it as related?
Some of the words you had up were related, like equity.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as we got in the conversation, we didn't quite clean it up.
What? You couldn't do that in 4 minutes?
Five.
Yeah, I gave you an extra minute. It should have been enough.
Well, okay, so you can't return to Holden if you die of it.
Thank you. We've got 5 minutes remaining, and I've got one more little preview to show you. So we have 3 minutes more to add to this list. I'll also start the next session, seeing what else we can add to this list. So,
good.
Yeah. Go ahead.
So a general idea about these that we talked about was that when science asks people to, or bumps up against what people believe and asks mm-hmm. them to change their actions or their beliefs, mm-hmm. you know, it's really hard to communicate science. And that this tied in with the idea of jubilee and the idea of release. You know, how do we release those ideas that we have had before so that we can move towards renewal and return?
Yeah, I'm not sure what to call that. What would you label it?
How about ideological commitments?
Oh, that's nice. That makes sense to the group? Not when I spell it like that. Mm-hmm. Okay, a couple more.
I think people's information bubbles, mm-hmm. that we're in different information bubbles, is really makes it difficult mm-hmm. to communicate.
Yep, not just on social media, but we also kind of self-segregate. We're more segregated now as a society than we were prior to the civil rights work in the 60s. We're actually more geographically divided. It's very interesting research to see how much we segregate by race, by income, by age. I do contra dance playing. It's one of the few circumstances in my life that's not stratified by age. It's really interesting to think about how seldom we do something like this, you know? A couple more?
There's a dilemma for me between equity and diversity. Mm-hmm. The woman I'm talking to is a public health professional, and so equity for her meant outcomes with vaccines, right?
Right.
Everybody has to have a study. Mm-hmm. I'm a theologian, so we get fuzzy, don't say anything that's really worth anything, but
yeah.
it's more like diversity is a mm-hmm. an embracing of different opinions and things, and mm-hmm. we don't always get to why that's important, where it's supposed to lead.
Mm-hmm.
So I think in the church world, the language diversity and equity needs to come into conversation with science communication in a different way.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I've heard these, by the way, described as diversity is a reality, inclusion is a practice, and equity is an outcome, when you're thinking about those things. So how would I phrase this one? Diversity.
What would you put? That's helpful for me. diversity is a reality.
Okay. Here we go. How about that? You invent a new way of writing words. So we have some to start with. Just be thinking about this. I think it's a great way to start the week is to think about, huh, what should we be looking at as a science communication issue? Really, this is a science communication issue? It has to do with any one of those three paradigms, how scientists get their stuff across, science as an argument, or how communication is kind of creating scientific realities for people. In what ways do those impact our ability to actually do this jubilee with each other, or just to live more appropriately with each other? I wanted to show you what's coming the rest of the week here, just so you can see it, that we will tomorrow be focusing on some of the stuff we hinted at today when we were looking at the coronavirus puzzleness, is which forces account for us being such skewed processors? Why are we so unobjective? And what are all the things that are present? I think we all have a couple of folk theories about why we're bad at this, but I want to show you some science, and then we'll test the science actually on you. We'll see how that works. Why we're such skewed processors and resistant knowers, especially of inconvenient empirical truths, inconvenient for some reason. Thursday, we're going to focus on representation. We're going to look at whose lives do and don't feature in science and science communication and STEM education, for example, and with what costs and what remedies. What's going on out there in the world that's actually pretty exciting, that's designed to do, Jim, when you talked about reading the goals list bottom up, I think there are a lot of folks in that space thinking about how do we start with that and sort of trust that the rest is then going to follow from those pieces, what's actually being done. So that's Thursday. And then Friday we'll get the most prescriptive. We'll think about then what can we glean from the research in science communication about actually communicating science in ways that can navigate or even thwart the systemic distortions that mean you can't talk to your uncle over dinner. All right, so if you've got a QAnon believer in your family who's really divorced from the science or empirical reality around, say, election findings, how many people actually voted in an election, what do you do about that? You can't just go, you know, well, you can. But what do we know? What does the research in science communication say about how do you actually bridge those divides, especially interpersonally and especially with people you love? So the advice won't be only in that space, but that'll be the center of the space on Friday. That's really what we're going to focus on. And I'll be as interested in what you provide that discussion as what I'm going to throw into it. So if you're coming looking for the Word of God on this, it's a really cobbled together word, and it's not from God. It's from scientists. And so we'll see, and I want you to measure it against your own experience. So that's what's upcoming this week. Again, thank you for coming to the session today. It's a delight to be here with you. Keep on talking.